all about this, so, because it is on the agenda tonight, and whether we vote on it or not, or whether we just discuss it.
You just have a list of the discussion.
Discussion tonight?
Discussion tonight, yeah.
And then we can.
Yeah, before Brad starts, let me just kind of set the table here for a second. It's gone through a number of iterations the ordinance has, like most ordinances do. Planning Commission approved a particular version, but there were some changes that we needed to make, they acknowledged. So this version you have in front of you includes what the Planning Commission, I think, approved, plus some additional changes that after talking with Derek, I made, and some changes that after Brad and I talked, I made further changes, but it does not include the changes that you and Derek talked about.
Okay,
just so you know that.
Okay.
Thank you, Faye. As Faye said, this has been the Planning Commission several times, John knows, and it's been through several different iterations. What I want to do is just kind of walk through this fairly briefly before we just kind of give you background as to where we're at. I want to talk about the location where this would be allowed in the city, permitted uses versus prohibited uses, and what the ALUA, which is the Administrative Land Use Authority, is going to be doing as part of this. Requirements for live and work, and then we'll go through some of the development standards. Faye passed out our latest version here, and so on page one it talks about the purpose. There's really nothing new about a live-work zone. Prior to the establishment of zoning in the early 1900s, most people lived and worked out of their homes. So it's really just kind of flipping the script a little bit and bringing that back to a certain extent. The reason why things got separated back in the early 1900s was because of the invent of manufacturing and some of the noxious stuff going on with manufacturing. So, but live-work is really not a new concept. It's an older concept. In regard to the town here, where live work would be allowed would be in your commercial land use designation of your general plan, and that basically is all your general or your general commercial zoning in town. So it'd be allowed in those areas and those areas only. It would not be allowed in any residential area whatsoever. This was something that Derek came up with, and I agree with it. Is that no live work development should be established on property less than 3.8 acres in size, and only in the general commercial land use designation. The reason for the acreage restriction is because you just don't want these small live-work developments, or somebody is building one live-work development. It should be a broader type development, like Blair has put together. It shouldn't be just one single house somewhere wanting to become a live-work. Permitted uses versus prohibited uses. This is where this is going to be a little bit different than your normal municipal code. And the reason is because of some stuff that Blair had brought up. He's got another one of these developments. He talked about he had a manufacturer of custom sleeping bags. I don't know how you capture that in a permitted use other than saying, you know, light industrial. The minute you say light industrial, what happens is you can get any type of light industrial type. So we kind of did this a little differently when I really started thinking about it. And instead of having permitted uses, the only use that's permitted is the residential use associated with whatever commercial use it is. Any other use that will be permitted will have to be approved by the Property Owners Association of the development and then approved by the Administrative Land Use Authority. And there's also some verbiage in here about it can't be noxious, it can't be noisy, it can't be those type of things. So it provides a little bit more flexibility for somebody coming in, because I don't know how we can figure out every single thing that might work in the zone without having someone do. And it does allow the Administrative Land Use Authority to deny use if it's not appropriate for that zone. So with that, on page three, I did provide some permitted or prohibited uses. Now, these are uses that are actually in your commercial zone right now, with the exception of the industrial use. But these are uses we kind of went through, the Planning Commission looked at, and they kind of agreed that these are probably not the right type of uses or the type of facility we're looking for the work. And so they have been issued as put forth as being prohibited. Now, that's not to say this can't be expanded. If you guys have some ideas about something that shouldn't be there, But generally speaking, these kind of uses are prohibited. On the next page, it comes to requirements for live work. And this whole section here, these 10 items have been hashed out a bunch of times. This is what Faye and I were talking about this morning. It was what has been to the Planning Commission. But a live work, occupation of a live work unit solely for residential purposes shall not be permitted. The Planning Commission, I understand, possibly the City Council, just doesn't want this to turn into a residential development. It should have some commercial component to it. So we're trying to avoid that situation. Now, there's going to be an exception to that. We'll get to that in a minute. Any business operating within a live work unit shall be required to obtain a business license, which makes sense. Live work shall not be occupied for residential purposes by any person except for the unit owner, long-term leasee, the business manager, employee. We added the leasee, I believe, at the last meeting. No portion of a live work unit shall be rented or occupied for short-term rental. It was never meant to be a short-term rental type situation. Client and customer visits to live work is permitted, obviously. Live work shall meet the health, safety, fire requirements of the city. Maximum of one employee per 1,000 square feet of floor area is permitted to work. And that's subject to the approval of the ALUA. And the reason for that is for the parking issue that kind of came up. I think everyone's concerned about the amount of parking stalls. So I'll get to that in a little bit here. And then a sign would be allowed. Now, when Faye and I talked this morning, I don't know, did you use the exact final wording, Faye, that you
proposed? Pretty close.
Okay.
You talking about a sign on the building?
Yeah, just a little sign.
Because I don't need that enough room out on front.
No,
there.
No.
Have a sign.
No, 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 no. Like,
on street, beyond
the building.
Yeah,
monument sign on street. So here's the exception that I was talking about, is that the ALUA can, based on findings and approval of the homeowners association or the property owners association, can approve modifications to numbers 1, 2, 4, and 6 above, and that the ALUA may place conditions and limit any type of approval as far as how long something would last. What came up at the Planning Commission was what would happen if a business went under, for example. Are you going to kick people out? And the answer is probably no. I don't know how you do that. If they have a mortgage, you're going to have to deal with it. And so what we kind of came down to is this provides the ALUA with the ability to work with somebody to give them time to figure out a way for them to either move on or come up with a new business or something that fits with the zone without just throwing them out the door, because I don't think we can legally.
Yeah, I don't think we can do that.
Yeah. So that's kind of the language.
Can you keep them from converting that lower part into housing?
Yeah, that's against residential.
Yeah.
Not allowed.
Yeah, that would be part of it. And then we can add conditions to it, too. For any type of flexibility, there can be conditions. And conditions on time frame as to how long they have to figure out the plan for themselves.
And that's all flexible with the ALUA, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So who... Go back over again. Who's allowed to stay up there? It'd be the business owner, and who?
It's the business owner. Yeah, a leasee. Let's see here.
Like a key person.
Yeah, there was like the business manager.
I think it's
number four.
I know that we've had some issues with.
The long-term leasing, I don't know if you'd want to just make it a long-term to anybody. You'd want to have somebody associated with the business, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's what my point was, is because I know we have some short-term rental people, and not that it would happen there. I'm not saying it would, but what's happened in the past based on experiences, people rent out a property on the property, and someone comes there, and they're only supposed to let family stay there. And they've got a great big family.
Yeah.
you can't, and to police that, you know, anybody can say, oh, yeah,
it's my cousin.
Cousin or something like that.
I was just going to say, yes, question. The long term leasee was something that was added just recently.
I can see that being a problem. The long term leasee, but if you got owner, business manager, or employee, they're associated with the business, and that's I think that was the purpose of them.
Yeah.
Their work.
Well, let me pose the situation for you. Suppose you've got an owner in there. He lives upstairs. He's got a bakery downstairs, which he owns and operates. The bakery's doing well. He suffers a heart attack, the owner. He needs to go up to Salt Lake to be close to medical facilities. Are you going to prevent him then from leasing out the top floor of that residential unit?
Yes.
I would say yes.
I got a great example for you. Not everybody's going to buy these as owners to, they're going to buy as a commercial application as well, which under this, as Brad has created such a great document, if you're a business owner that wants to, is this an investment property, are they allowed and through this zone to be able to rent or lease the building to another business? So that's where that, some of that language came about. It's not to abuse it, it's to make sure that the owner of the building is responsible for the use. But if, let's say, I've got a gentleman right now that wants to buy Mears garage doors. He won't live there, but he's buying it from a commercial use as an investment property. He may store garage doors in the basement or in the garage level, but that's where these guys came up with the great language to allow for that opportunity for him to lease it out, because he won't live there, because that's the beauty of the commercial to residential live work combination.
So what relation would that person that he's leasing that out to have with the business?
Well, that's one of the reasons the language came up. This could, if you, let's say you wanted to buy this as a commercial building to rent,
right. And
he leases it out to another business that still has to follow only ALUA, approved business. They have to have a business license that comes through the HOA to get approved. So you have these checks and balances to make sure that there is nothing.
And I could see that leasing it out to another business, and then that business would have
either he lives there
or an employee lives there or a manager lives there, mm-hmm. but he's associated with the business. But if you're just going to rent it out to anybody,
and then you're just going to turn it into a residential.
Then it's just a rental.
Well, then they have to have a business.
Yeah, I would say you've got to be associated with the business.
And his language in there is brilliant. You have to have a business in these units, for sure.
Yeah.
Whoever's up above needs to be associated with the business that's down, whether it's the guy that bought the building or whoever he leased it to.
He's bought it for a rental.
Yeah.
Long-term rental.
But if his business is still in the basement or the bottom part, and he's not going to live there, and he just rents it out to somebody else, that's basically just turning it into an apartment.
Yeah.
You know, the nice thing about the Planning Commission having spent so much time, and now we are, is that with the fields, we have a very good example of what it can potentially be, what a live-work unit property can be. Having the 3.5 acres identified that it has to be that size and it has to be the general or the retail commercial, not tourist commercial, that means that there are seven to eight properties in town identified that can be live-work. So when we're making these decisions, we have what Blair's done, and most of that falls into kind of what we have here. But we kind of have to look at it, what's it going to look like 5 years down the road when others come in? So either you like what Blair's done or you don't like what Blair's done. It's a good example of what work live could be, but what are we thinking long term? And to me, that's where it gets kind of difficult on the wording and why this, you know, in theory, it was kind of like when we went through the short-term rentals and to prove 10%, which we did, and then bring it back to 7.5%, which had been 5%, is that you always hope for the best in people, but the reality is that you're not always going to get it. And so I think we do need to be really careful with the wording.
Now, was it in general and...
General and retail.
Retail commercial. I thought you said it was just in general commercial.
Well, that's the general plan land use designation,
Oh. Okay.
which encompasses all your commercial.
Yeah, I think Patty makes a good point. Whatever you do, you're going to have to realize that you've got that property that you're dealing with, but that means that
this
there's six other properties.
Yeah,
that
we're kind of lucky in the sense that we have an example that we can look to, and we can look at the parking, and we can look at the way they've done it, and the number of stories, and first floor, and all of that. It's kind of a good guideline as we decide what we want for the whole city, because that's really what we're deciding.
So, you know, here's a question. If we're going to say that it's residential up there, why does whoever lives there have to be tied to the business? I mean, the one tied to the business might be messier and a worse situation.
Because the idea, this would be the difference between live work, where the number of individuals on site is really minimal, like four per building, you know, when you count two employees and the owner and a manager, whatever, and then one to two people living above related to the business. Kind of where you're talking about will be the mixed use, where apartments on top and then all commercial on the bottom, and anybody can rent those. So kind of two different zones. So the idea is to keep this, in my thought, is to keep this really kind of tight. And as far as who lives on top, they could be messy, they could be good, they could be whatever. It's a gamble.
Mixed use would have a lot more parking.
And more apartments above and stuff like that with businesses.
Well, yeah, but I'm just saying, let's say I bought one of those businesses and I've got three or four young adult kids that live with me. Like, as far as parking goes, I just don't see how regulating that it's got to be connected to the business is going to reduce the amount of people that might have cars that are living there. Like,
well, that's why the limited number of parking spaces, and there's only one person per 1,000 square feet of rental.
Right, so I'm saying that's limited already by the parking. You know, I'm looking at it from the business side of things. If I were going to invest and buy that,
I guess it gets into. I think it gets into, is this, if you're a business owner, is this a good fit? Is it a good, with the whatever the city passes, is it a good fit for your business and life? I guess would be what it is, and there would be those restrictions. So, it wouldn't fit everybody.
Because I would imagine most small business owners maybe couldn't afford. I think most individuals that will be purchasing these are going to be investors, those who own commercial properties.
So they'll probably be leasing it out to a business owner who doesn't have the capital but can afford a lease.
Right, but now I'm very limited because now I've got to lease it out to a small business that is going to agree that they want to live above it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the residential doesn't have to be occupied as residential. It could be more commercial. I don't know. You're right, Micah.
We were first looking at this from the city count or the planning commission when it was first brought up 7 years ago or whatever, the intent was more of the mixed use that they weren't worried about. But what we wanted to do is we wanted to protect the ground level or that portion as retail to protect. We're very limited on what we have for commercial in our corridor. And so giving it away to anything else, it can hinder us a lot. So the purpose was that if there's going to be affordable housing or attainable housing, whatever name you want to put it to, but that first 10 or 12 feet is commercial, could be anybody, and they could be apartments above it. That was what the original intent was from the city, like much like they've done in Salt Lake at the Gateway, where they've done it in Hurricane St. George down there on Main Street. That's the mixed use.
Yeah.
And it gets confused sometimes with live work, but that's originally what the city was going for with that, we've got going now.
Yeah.
Back on just the can you rent or can you not rent, I don't think you can legally stop somebody from going through a long-term rental. And if you think about it, if I had a house sitting right there and I wanted to rent that long term, there's no law that could stop me from renting that long term. There's obviously the short term rental restrictions, you have your code. I'm not aware of anything long term. And I think that would also apply here, that they do have the ability to lease this long term. I think you could put some stuff in that says you can't sublease it from there. And we've tried to stop the same, you know, you have upper floor residential and lower business, you can't do that. But the structure itself, I don't know how you could stop leasing.
I don't know either. That's why we put it in the way it's in there now.
Well, that's what I'm seeing. You know.
You know what? I might have shown up. So basically what you're saying is, and this is the other part that I have a concern with, is that they have to have a business license. I think they need to be operating a business. Anybody can have a business license and just have it be a shell and do nothing with it. It has to be, and I don't know how or legally if we can say that, but on this long-term lessee, I mean, what we don't want is a long-term lessee who's residential. If the long-term lessee was commercial, great, but not just residential.
Right. It wouldn't be live work.
That'd be a really expensive rental, though.
It's just mixed use.
You know, if you're not.
If you're going to do a long-term lease and not have a part of your business, but and so live work to me means you live there and then you work there. You know, so we.
So are you saying that some of these can't be enforced, these requirements?
No. What do you mean?
So the requirement that you have to have a business there to live above, you're saying...
I think that can be enforced. I'm just saying I don't think you can stop somebody from a long-term rental. If somebody purchased that and says, I now want to rent it to
my
XYZ
business,
they're going to live upstairs.
So you're talking commercial rental.
Yeah.
Not residential.
Well, both. It'd be both.
It'd be both, but not just residential.
Yeah. I thought you were saying that. I thought you were saying they could just rent the top no matter what we do.
Well, the first stop is going to be his property owners association.
Yeah.
They've got to get through that first, and they go to the ALUA.
Okay.
And that's why we tried to figure out this other little caveat we put in here about in case something does go wrong, like what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think the homeowners association is going to resolve the concern that you have.
Maybe.
Yeah, that's a big maybe.
So here's my other concern. This is just kind of food for thought. Maybe I worry too much. A homeowners association, I've lived in different complexes than that have had HOAs. And when they're good, it's great. When they're not good, it's horrible because you can't, you don't have anybody to go to. You know, the situation isn't bad enough to go to the police, but you can't talk to the neighbor because they're just not going to be willing to talk. And you have an HOA who won't do anything. And so the offender says, well, HOA won't do anything about it. What are you going to do? You know? So the way I feel about this is just saying that there's a property owner association is not enough. It seems like we need to somehow identify that property owner association is, like, I don't know, a business in good standing, they have experience, they're local, or at least they have a local representative, all of that kind of thing. Because all of this, I mean, when Blair sells these off, he's going to be gone. And Blair's just an example. So there could be more of these in town. And those, we've got to think about that is, the HOA could be non-existent. It could be there on paper, but could be non-existent. And then what do we do? So we can't put too much reliance on the HOA. And then the ALUA, I mean, when you get right down to it, that's pretty much, I think, somebody from the Planning Commission and city staff. Laverkan's growing, and city staff is not going to have time to handle every little thing that comes up around town. So we need to have this whole ordinance very strong before we go into it, so the things that do end up in ALUA are minimal or of good enough consequence that they warrant it. So I think we have some steps to take care of before we can make a decision on all of this as to overall zoning and that.
Blair, what do you anticipate a unit selling for?
6.5 is our base price. And maybe I can shed a little bit of light on why this created, because granted, this is going to be citywide, not just Blair's project, so I appreciate that. So the concept of flex living and live workspace, as Brad says, it's not new. It's old, actually. It's just becoming more modern. He made a comment of, you know, people can't afford. Well, we're getting to the point where people can't afford a house and they can't afford a business. And so this is an option to combine. There's also, in terms of flex, commercial owners that want to invest but never use the facility that they own. It allows them to do that. The restrictions that Brad's put in there in phase is as encompassing as I've seen in a lot of the live work stuff. Even Hurricane City has a live work zone that's currently in place. I like yours better. So as this kind of evolved, I came in here with the concept of let's just build these as commercial only, and then there was the opportunity that there's a potential for a mixed use, which as Brad and Faye have described, and all of you, they're different. Mixed use and live work, they are a different animal. And as a developer, I like to see that diversity within a city, that someone who wants a retail bottom and rent their apartment up top, it's not us. If you want to own this, your own facility with your own individual tax ID number and not rely on a landlord, we're an option. If you want to run a business, and mind you guys, businesses are, as you said, we don't know what businesses are going to go in there. All we can say is what we don't want in there and doesn't flow. We don't want nightly rentals. I did the parking specifically, so there's not a lot of traffic, right? And in this day and age, businesses are not manpower. They might be internet power. They might be a UPS truck coming in and out once every week. So the checks and balances for us, and you're 100% right, the HOA will be turned over, just like every other HOA in time. The original starter of any HOA, I couldn't tell you who originally owns the HOA that they started 10, 15, 20 years ago. Do we set everything in motion and in place that we want it to be structured as clean as possible and work perfectly? Absolutely. Is it going to? Absolutely not. We 100% agree. I'm going to sell all of these out, probably, and the HOA will be transferred over into an internal board, like most HOAs, or there's going to be a professional HOA manager that will come in and regulate. The ELUA was a great suggestion citywide to say how much liability does the city want to say yes you can, no you can't. The ELUA is a great checks and balances. Then you have the HOA is a checks and balance. Then you have the business license. So I can't even sell one until their business that's going to be used in that facility is approved through the business license team, the ELUA, and the HOA. So we're trying to put everything in place to eliminate or lessen as much of the liability to the city, to us, along the board. So that's kind of the short history of what this is. We've tried to identify putting things into a box, and with this flex space, the beauty about it is there's really no box that it all fits in. Now that can be really scary because it's like we don't know what's going to happen. There's also that also creates a lot of opportunity for people that don't have any other opportunity other than this. So I 100% support what the process is, slow, correct, and applicable. But to answer your question, it's when we start identifying exactly who's going to be in there, we don't know. And it's not going to work for everybody on purpose. We don't want to have a huge parking lot and a bunch of traffic and a bunch of this and that. We want to have very specific people that can, are able, and will follow the guidelines because there are a lot of checks and balances in here that will scare a lot of people away. That's okay. That means that people are the ones that are actually going through the process and are going to hopefully follow the process. So in terms of that live work to mixed zone, I get how it can be very overlapping, but Brad's done a great job in trying to separate those and be very clear and defined as to what is allowable within live work and what is also allowable in mixed use. And to be able to say these are the top, you know, these are the 10 things that are going to fit in there, we can not necessarily say that, but what we can say is what scares us about and who do we not want in there relative to a negative impact of the city. And I think that's where this language is, they've done a really good job at it. So, did I answer any questions or was I just ramble? I don't know. That was probably a ramble.
You know, time-wise.
I appreciate it.
We need to switch subjects. And we're going to discuss this more in the next meeting. And
yeah.
Because it's on the agenda as a discussion item. So we can continue that discussion in the regular city council meeting. The next thing that I want to talk about is in this meeting is it was brought up in our last city council of people that got the high water bills from July. Now, and that we maybe ought to do something about those people. Darren brought this up.
Everybody else doesn't care, only
and
me.
So I've talked to myself a lot about this, and I thought maybe there's something we could do. I think it would be absolutely wrong to change the ordinance and do something different to what we already voted for.
Right. And I'm not proposing that we change.
I think we did the right thing. We went through all of the steps that we needed to go through. We did a water study that, and then we discussed it at the city council. What's the best approach? And given the data that the engineers gave us, and given the fact that just about, I'm guessing, 95% of the cities in this state, I would almost bet that 95% of them don't charge enough for the water. And what happens is when you go to do a big project, you don't have the money available to do it. And so you go to the state, the drinking water board or the CIB board, and you say, we want to do this project. Can you give us some money? Hopefully you'll give us some grant money, and they'll look at what our water rates are, and they'll say, we can't give you any money because you're not charging enough. You couldn't pay this back to us. And that's based on an over 20-year or 30-year time. They go through all of that stuff. They've been preaching this for, I know, 25 years. They've been preaching this, but not very many cities have done anything about it. We've taken the steps, and I think right now we're probably in a good position where we're charging enough for repairs and maintenance on our system and replacing it over time, and that's what we need to do, because over time you've got to replace that system. It's going to get old. The pipes will get undersized. We already have some that are undersized in our community, but because we've done some things, it's adequate right now. But as the city continues to grow, we're going to have to replace some of those pipelines, replace some of the valves. We've already starting to replace some valves that have blown up on us.
I don't think anyone's arguing that we
I know,
we have the, we all feel good about raising the rates.
Right, but those are things that need to be taken into consideration. There's valves that have been in the ground for over 25 years, and back then they didn't have stainless steel bolts on them, and so the bonnets are blowing off of them because the bolts rust out and it blows up through the street and you have a big hole and it's quite a repair. Those are happening now. And so, but over time they've perfected some of those products like that. So all the bolts on this valve now comes with stainless steel bolts. They'll last a long time. they might last in a 50 years or whatever, you know. But we, those are things we have to take into consideration. With what we have done, we can go to the Drinking Water Board and say, look, we need some money to do a project, and this is the project we want to do. Will you loan us the money? And we can pay it back over time. And so I think we've done what we need to do, and we've also built into that a conservation factor so that people aren't just wasting water. And I think we found out in July's bill that there were people wasting water. I'll give you a couple of examples. One example was a guy's had a leak for months, I think maybe even over a year. And he didn't fix it. He'd been notified a whole bunch of times. It was over 100 gallons an hour. And so when he got his bill, it was $1,200 in July. The leak's fixed now. And there, I got a list of leaks. I think there are 85 people in town right now that are on the leak list. That the meters we have will tell the residents whether they got a leak or not. And so we notify those people that you've got a leak. I got a notification on a couple months back that I had a leak. And I immediately started looking where I might have the leak. It was the toilet. The flapper on the toilet was leaking. It was just a small leak, but I was able to fix it. So that's a good thing that we've done some of those things so that we can notify the people that they've had a leak. And there was a friend of mine that had a leak. He got notified. He found the leak. He fixed it. And those things need to be taken care of. A lot of the people that overuse their water, single lady with the kids, turned the sprinkler on, let the kids play in the water all day long and on the trampoline, she got a high water bill. I bet you she's not doing that now. And those are things that I think we've taken the right steps to do. Now, it was a wake-up call for quite a few people. There were 123 people in July that had gotten into Tier 5, which is $10 a 1,000 gallons, over 33,000 gallons. Some of them got a really high water bill. And there's one of the comments was, this was a not just a wake-up call, but a slap in the face of, hey, I wished I would have known. Well, we tried to let people know as best we could. We probably maybe could have done a little bit better. I got thinking we should have notified people on Yopify. That goes out to a lot of people in town, all the ones that have a cell phone or something that we can notify them. But maybe we could have done better. But now they know. And I'm going to, my proposal is not to change the ordinance, but give them a reprieve for July, August, and September. We got the data on August already because the bills went out yesterday. There was, I think, 80-something people in Tier 5 and 60-something people in Tier 4. So it had gone way down. There were 62 or 8 in Tier 4 and 123 in Tier 5 in July. So it's gone down quite a bit. I would say give them a reprieve on Tier 4 and 5. Bill them for Tier 3, which is $3 and something per thousand, anything above that range. Some would get a credit for those 3 months, but that allows them the opportunity to fix some leaks, make some changes on how they're using their water, and then come October, I think we've given them plenty of time. They've got the notice in their water bill. That's my proposal. It's up to the council whether you want to do something like that or just say it is what it is. The more I think about it, we probably should have implemented this May 1st And the 1st of June, people would be making adjustments to their water system.
Well, we discussed it, we passed it in April, at the April 16th meeting, but then it came back to the council, I think, for technicalities. We added in the 3% annual increase. But I don't know, Darren, if it makes you feel any better, I have a short-term memory for a lot of numbers, so I actually pulled up the council meeting, and I looked at the minutes from the April 16th meeting. Every single one of us were concerned about the negative impact on people who couldn't afford it. So you're not the only one who cared. And Micah
well,
had a really
good point. I'm glad you care.
Micah said, well, if we're going to help people out, are we helping them out on the whole bill, or are we helping them out on the difference? And that's the consideration, too, which kind of falls with what Kelly's suggesting of
just
4s and 5s, take them down to a tier 3.
I looked at the data, too, on 80-something% of the people in town were in the first tier. Now, so I looked at my water bill. I took the June bill, not my July bill, and I used 7,000 gallons in July. Had a bunch of kids coming to town, so they used a lot of water. And so my bill increased from June to July $11.50. Now that, to me, is not a huge increase for a family. But if I had been overusing that water, it would have been a lot more. And I think those that are not using the water for, if they're just wasting water, I think you need to make it painful for them.
But Mayor, it's city policy that if someone has a water leak and they come into the city and they have a water leak, we take them down to the lower tier, and they only have to pay the lower tier if they can show they have a water leak. Now, if they've used it to water their grass, then that's a different story. But so the guy you talked about did get a credit to his bill already. He was taken down to a lower tier to pay for it. You can't not make them pay for the water, but you can reduce the...
And we know who that has water leaks. We've got a list of them. There's 85 people that have leaks. And there's some of them are being fixed right now. But you couldn't just come in and say, hey, I think I got a water leak. Well, we know whether you got a water leak or not.
Yeah, we can show that.
It shows right up on your meter.
I'm not disputing any of that.
Right.
My biggest, as I mentioned in city council, my biggest concern is, you know, when your bill goes, like the Webbs, Joe Webb and whatever her name is, goes from 200 to 800 or 900, that's a slap in the face, right?
Yeah.
They probably did have a leak. They don't irrigate with it or anything, so... but there's a bunch of those. I think Derek said we collected $67,000 in those two tiers. So I think we can give them a little break, get them through the summer, and then go full bore.
Well, you're going to have other situations, too. We had a lady call today, and she's a renter, and she doesn't have a leak. And her water bill is $400. The landlord basically waters the lawn with it, and he's not going to change it. So she's, I know what I'd do in her situation. I'd shut the water off on the lawn, let it die.
Yeah.
And let the landlord make a decision to get that fixed.
Is that what she said, told the landlord?
This was
a different
lady. And so she's in the situation now, if she wants a lawn in front, she's going to, because the landlord won't fix it, won't convert over to, at least that's what she says. So there's going to be that situation. She's already made payment arrangements that I was allowed to do. She'll still pay her water bill before the end of the month, but she did make some arrangements. But so she's in that situation with a landlord refuses to make a change.
The mayor's suggestion would give her some reprieve through September, She can figure it out through June.
Right.
I think what happens with a lot of people is they're watering every day. They don't need to.
Right.
Well,
even in the hot summer, you don't need to. Right?
My yard's as green as any yard in town, and I knew it was coming, and I told my wife and daughter, quit using so much water. And we've been under 8,000, and we have a 40-foot pool and hot tub, and so it can be done.
Yeah, you bet.
Why can't we go by and because of they're used to it and shut it down?
Shut what down?
The water off.
They're paying it.
They're paying the bill. They can use the water, but
make them pay for it.
I think a lot of people didn't realize they're using more water than they should. One guy was watering four times a day, and he didn't know it because his sprinkler clock had done something, and so he was watering four times a day. And Kyle Love Lady went over to his house and said, "Hey, this is what's happening." And he fixed his clock, and so he's not using a whole lot of water. And there's no reason to water every day. My lawn's green. I water three times a week.
So, Mayor, can I ask you, going back to your idea about Tier 4 and 5 going down to Tier 3 for July, August, September, is that everybody in Tier 4 and 5?
Yeah. There's about 200 people that were in Tier 4 and 5 in August, and there's,
80.
I think 130 or so in Tier 4 and 5 that was July. For August, there's about, it had gone down to, I think, around 130.
And then you said it just went down to
80. I wouldn't want to issue them any credit checks. I think it just needs to be a
couple of
the rules. Yeah, 80 in Tier 5 and I think 60 something.
They'd be happy with that, I'm sure.
Just Tier 4 is $5 or something.
How many total connections do we have?
About
1,500.
It's somewhere in there.
In that neighborhood. About
1,600.
It's 86%, I believe, of the people are below 4 and 5. And using the water responsibly. But there's about 8% of the people that are in that tier, and those are the ones that are screaming.
So there's a place in town, Vintage Park, they don't have access to irrigation. It's one of the few places in town. So
River?
Vintage Park that looks out over where they're building this sewer plant, they don't have secondary irrigation in that part of town.
How could they not? I have it by my house right under Vintage.
No, you're above.
You're quite a ways.
No, my rental.
Oh, well.
It might not be
all of Vintage Park, but
because
I think we have irrigation at Vintage Park itself.
Oh.
It might be those guys.
The people. I thought you meant Vintage Park.
No, there's a section of them out there in this corner.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So if they're going to want grass, they're going to be watering with culinary water.
Mayor, I think, I think we've done the right thing. When we do this right, if we're wasting water and we didn't know it, we'll figure it out and fix it. And if we were wasting it, just moving forward, we're going to all have to be better with how we use our water.
I agree.
And our rates, I can guarantee you across the county, if other cities haven't done it, rates are not going down, and they're not going to stay the same for water.
The day of cheap water is over.
Right. So, but I love the idea of, we did what we could, and we probably could have done more, and let's give them a chance, give them that reprieve, and now everyone knows and has some time to, and we're out of the warmer months, right, as well, so it buys them some more time to.
Yeah. That was my thinking. I just needed to get your thoughts on it because
we can't vote on that tonight.
No, well, there's no vote on something it. You're going to have to put on the agenda.
If you're agreeable to something like that, then Faye could How are we going to do it?
We'd have to draft up a resolution.
Resolution?
Of just kind of amending the rates for those particular months.
And then my other suggestion would be there were roughly 200 people that were in those top two tiers the first month. We got a few less in August. We may have a few less in September, but I would suggest maybe in September, this month, draft up a letter and send to those people that are in those tiers and explain to them what we're doing and why we're doing it and tell them, yes, we gave them a reprieve, but come October, it's over.
Yeah, it's got to be very clear because you'll have that person that still doesn't do it and he'll complain in October.
And
we've got to make it clear that
if we did that, I think there's no excuse from anybody, especially if we gave them notice.
I have one question. Yes. This Kyle might be able to answer it. Do we have, I don't get out and about amongst the community as much as I used to, but when I did, I knew a lot of them that were on fixed incomes. And the only thing they bring in was, my mother was one of them. She brought in, her and dad brought in $800 a month Social Security, and that was it. Now, they passed away just within the last 5 years, I think, my mother. Is there any out there in the community that would be on that kind of an income?
Well, I'm sure there are, but I wouldn't know how to identify them. That would be.
We talked about that in the April meeting.
We talked about a hardship, but you're going to have to develop
I probably brought
the
it
criteria
up.
Would be to meet that hardship. And because everybody will claim it if you don't have something that.
I don't know if you checked your email today, but there was an email about the post that I put online, and I apologize if that was inappropriate. I was just trying to gather feedback from the community on how this was affecting them. One of the comments was from a senior citizen who said, I'm on fixed income, like, there's no way I can pay anymore.
But like I said, those that are on fixed income are probably not using that much water, and if they're under 8,000 gallons.
Just a few dollars.
The increase is 6 Diet Cokes a month.
You know? How many dollars is it?
Yeah, the increase, if somebody's using 8,000 gallons, the old rate would have been $50.08. The new rate is $65.67, so a difference of $15.59.
I remember that when we talked about that.
And so it's.
But $15.59 could be a lot, but I think as far as helping people who are on really fixed incomes, we had a couple of different ideas. There's another city, Milford or something like that, that Blaine from Sunrise had searched out, and he couldn't get a good handle on it. It was suggested people on Medicaid, different things, and we none of us had any solutions, and none of us really knew where to go to look. So it would almost be something where Laverkan as a city would have to decide to develop some kind of a hardship program for any number of things and have the budget to do that. And I don't even know how.
I'm surprised at how few of those I've heard about, though. I put it on Facebook for crying out loud. So I've heard of it. Only one.
I know that when we look at our water bills every month, and they come in that they're using 4,000 gallons month after month after month, and they do that for a year, and then they have a high water bill because of a break. Do we say, well, they've had it for a good bill of 4,000 gallons for a year?
I think what Kyle was saying is we do have it built in our ordinance. If they can prove they've had a break, we don't charge them we charge them the rate.
But he's saying, what about all the prior months?
And I'm just saying that.
Well, if you're 4,000 gallons, that's pretty normal.
That's right. I only use 4,000 in my house.
And we've had months the same thing, 3,000 and 4,000 gallons. But when we get family coming, it's
different story.
It is a huge different story. They don't know how to turn the tap off or the shower.
And another thing I hate to hear every time we do this is we need to conserve water.
What good does it do us to conserve water just so Washington City and St. George can build another subdivision? If we've got the water right and we've got the water, let's let it run down the gutter until we build a house that we can put a house on. That's just my thought. I hate to hear that.
Well, a lot of people, actually, I think a lot of people.
We're out of time. Well,
so, Kelly, are we giving, just one last point, are we giving an unfair break to the Tier 4 and 5 people and not to others? That was my only other consideration.
I don't think so.
Are we leaving anybody out of giving a good deal?
I you're still going to be paying Tier 3, right?
They'll still be paying Tier 3 for that. But I just think if you're all okay with that, we'll have draft up the resolution. If not, I just need to get your feeling.
Yeah, I'm for it.
Okay. We'll just move forward with that. Let's go to City Council meeting and continue our discussion with the master.
Every time I hear it.
Oh, careful.
You bet.